Welcome to Disrespect, exploring the stigma around disability, providing information and interviews to entertain and challenge listeners who care about, or care for, or may themselves have become someone with a disability. This week in Ottawa, the Senate recommended a health advocacy organization for people with mental disabilities. Last week, we listened to Jennifer Chambers explain the political pressures and a shift to the right and its endorsement of biological definitions of illness and the pressures on doctors and their profession. This week, we continue with our interview with Jennifer Chambers.
Doctors are the only people who are covered by OHIP.
Right.
That also creates a bias because people who can't afford a therapist who isn't covered by OHIP have to see someone who's sort of medically, biologically oriented.
Okay.
So, you know, say someone who has money chooses to see a private psychologist or social worker.
Right.
Or the kind of psychiatrist who does more long-term sort of talking therapy.
Right.
But someone without much money is more likely to get your once-a-month visit to the psychiatrist or GP who gives the medication and then
follows up with exams and
takes
tests.
A look at them, yeah. And doesn't really ask them questions in depth. And one of the great concerns that we have that we advocate about is that patients aren't giving fully informed consent. According to the law, fully informed consent means that someone's being told what their diagnosis is, what the treatment is that's being recommended and why, and what the risks and benefits are of that treatment.
Right.
Now, it's our opinion that people are rarely given adequate information about the risks.
What are they being deprived of? Research information, essentially, then? As we spoke about in the beginning?
Yeah, information that's certainly well available in the research. I mean, for example, when traveling around the province, I and other sort of critics in the area certainly stated for years that antidepressants, evidence suggested that they had a low rate of effectiveness, a significant chance of causing harm to people in terms of the akathisia, which akathisia is something that can cause people to become violent or suicidal, violent towards themselves or others, would be an example.
The research seems to show that this risk is much higher at the onset of taking. Does that imply that the risk disappears with time or that the people who are made violent quit the medication?
That's a good question, and I don't know if that's been fully assessed.
Right.
Part of the problem is that as long as people deny that this is happening, then it doesn't tend to get studied very carefully.
That's true.
It's very recent that it's been admitted. I mean, I've been going around talking about it, for example, for many years. And in doing so, I and other people who have been critics in the area have been dismissed and said that we're speaking from ideology.
Oh.
And that it's interesting because even though, to address that very concern, I tend to travel with my stack of research articles.
That's kind of newspeak, too, isn't it? I mean, the people who are speaking from ideology that every disability is medical are accusing you of ideological bias.
Yeah, exactly. The medical model is an ideology. And I'm not saying that the medical model is never right. I'm sure that sometimes it is. But it needs to be broadened. Biology isn't the only root of human distress. And I found that there's so much authority placed in the medical profession that if I'm on a panel and I have a stack of research articles beside me, supporting every sentence that I say, nonetheless, there will be those who attribute every point that I make to ideology and any off-the-cuff statement that the doctor makes to science. So it's made it very difficult to get good information to people about the treatments that are being proposed, and it's only in the last year that regulatory bodies who should have been on top of this long ago have finally been forced by various lawsuits to recognize the dangers of antidepressants.
So lawsuits have forced them to. Are these American lawsuits or Canadian lawsuits or both?
Both. I think, though, the main source of lawsuits is generally United States. There have been some in Britain as well, quite a few in Britain. I think the British regulatory body was actually the first to issue a statement about the dangers.
So change originates offshore, and then we import it much later, probably.
Yeah.
But there are other sources of social pressure, are there not? I understand that children's high school and public school principals have recommended that they go on drugs and put pressure on the parents by threatening to withdraw the children from school if they're not.
Yes, it's truly shocking. In the U.S., children have actually been taken away from parents who won't consent to having their children drugged.
By the Children's Aid?
Yeah, their equivalent of Children's Aid, yeah.
Really?
And I know that I've known of parents here who've had to fight to not have their children put on drugs. I was speaking with a director of a children's organization who was saying that he tries to resist all the pressure to put the children there on drugs. And these are troubled children in his organization.
But even he comes under that pressure.
Yeah, he said that what he tends to do, when they have too many children in classrooms with not enough attention to go around, and often at home with working parents, a strain to meet enough of the child's demands as well for attention, then you not surprisingly get very rowdy children. And what this guy, who's quite innovative, was saying is that when the children have excessive energy, he tends to tell them to go outside and run around the track and then come in when they're ready, which is a lot healthier outlet than drugging people. I mean, really, I don't know that children were designed for what is essentially work day, you know, going to school for...
That's true.
...from 8:30 to 4, and then they have homework, and that's worse than some people have in their work life.
That's true.
It's no wonder that they are in some distress.
Mm-hmm. What's the solution? How do people become more aware of this? How did they successfully resist it? For a start, for instance, how would a mother successfully resist the Children's Aid imperative that her children should be on drugs, especially if she's poor?
There should be a lot more of the good research that's made available to people. And that was something that we tried to do during the time that we had funding to go around Ontario and talk to people. But right now, I'd say that most of the sources of information tend to deliver information with a particular more of a medical model bias.
Right.
So it's hard for her to get the information that supports her perspective.
Right.
But certainly there have been increasing questions raised about the safety of these drugs on children.
Well, would she go, for instance, to Drug Safety Canada for information if she didn't want to drug her children? Would she go there for information to present to the Children's Aid about why she doesn't think it's beneficial?
Well, Health Canada would be a good place to start.
Really?
But they're often quite slow.
Mm-hmm.
Canada's regulatory body just recently started releasing warnings about the use of SSRIs, which is the antidepressants that seem for some people to cause a risk of violent suicidality. But in my opinion, this evidence has been around for many, many years, and it's only because of the outside pressures that this finally came about. So the difficulty of accessing the research is hard for people who don't know how to do it. I'd say she may want to call advocacy organizations if she can.
Such as?
If it's about drugging, well, it's difficult because searching the internet for advocacy organizations is a good idea. There's a place called Mind Freedom.
Okay.
On the internet. We will eventually have a website, but we don't at this time. There's the Psychiatric Patient Advocate Office, although they advocate primarily for people in institutions.
Okay.
They might be able to send her in a good direction.
All right. So there's two, and perhaps Drug Safety Canada as well.
And now for a short break from our interview.
I'm a two-fisted mind. Took me all around the world.
This week in Ottawa, the Senate recommended a health advocacy organization for people with mental disabilities. Last week, we listened to Jennifer Chambers explain the political pressures and a shift to the right and its endorsement of biological definitions of illness and the pressures on doctors and their profession. This week, we continue with our interview with Jennifer Chambers.
What we really need in Canada is a national mental health legal advocacy organization that has a research component to support the advocacy.
So yours is provincial?
We're a tiny organization. We have 2 full-time equivalent positions. We're funded by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, and we're located there, but membership, all the clients, give the direction to the organization. The center is Toronto-based, but has satellites around the province.
Yes.
However, the center itself has 20,000 clients, so it's hard for us to meet the need with our small organization.
Right.
I'm also involved with something called the Mental Health Legal Advocacy Coalition, which has even less funding, but has been involved in a few Supreme Court cases trying to uphold the rights of people in the psychiatric system.
Very good.
In the U.S., there's something called Bazelon Center, which is a center for mental health legal advocacy, in which they also have a social science department which researches things like the efficacy or the dangers of drugs in order to use them for court cases. But we don't have anything like that in Canada, and I think it's a real loss because people call me from all over the country, lawyers who constantly have to recreate the wheel
because
there's no central source of information.
Right. It's odd that the legal profession has not played a role in creating these advocacy groups. I mean, I'm aware of a recent approach to a lawyer that resulted in a simple declaration, which must be quite common, is that we can't be certain of victory, so we require a retainer, and that retainer is whatever it is, $10,000 or something, or we cannot go ahead. And with the proper research behind a case, a lot of the burden would be removed from the law firms, and a lot of the need for these expensive retainers and the likelihood that cases won't be pursued because of them would be eliminated.
That's true. Lawyers don't generally understand social science research very well. I've worked with a number of lawyers on a number of cases, and they're usually very grateful to have someone who's able to explain the research in a way that will assist their case, but they don't usually think of it themselves.
Right.
It's one of the things the Mental Health Legal Advocacy Coalition is trying to change, but it's an organization that only has funding sort of from project to project, so it's limited in what we can do.
Okay.
We really need a funded national organization.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. So are there any beginnings towards something like this?
The Mental Health Legal Advocacy Coalition has got some funding from the Court Challenge Program to develop a case that we're going to use to take, we're hoping to take before the Supreme Court to challenge some parts of the way the forensic mental health system works to to ensure that people's charter rights were upheld.
Forensic system meaning?
It's people who come into the mental health system to the court.
Okay, okay.
And part of what we're looking to do is to bring a case to the Supreme Court about people in the forensic system not getting their needs sort of properly addressed, that their needs are being excessively narrowly defined as sort of medical, biological, and they're not getting all their other needs addressed.
Even in the court system and in the penal system?
Well, it's not in the penal system. If people are found, for example, not guilty by reason of insanity,
right,
then they get sent to a sent by the courts to a psychiatric facility.
Right.
And what we found, I think we're the only group that has ever done research actually asking people in the forensic system itself, how have you found the system? Have you found it helpful? Questions like that.
Okay.
And for the most part, people say that almost the only treatment that they have gotten has been pharmaceutical, and they have not had assistance with their issues of abuse, lack of education, need for vocational training, all the other practical areas that allow someone's life to sort of succeed or not.
Right. Do you think this is a form of discrimination? It certainly seems not to be covered by the Ontario Human Rights Act the way it's administered. And it doesn't seem to be addressed in the Ontarians with Disabilities Act.
True.
And yes. It does sound like discrimination to me. Does it to you?
It does. And partly what the Supreme Court said in a previous case that we were involved with is that the forensic system is supposed to help the person to reintegrate into society. That's sort of the purpose of the forensic system, to bring them to a state where they can be reintegrated into society. And they said that that is an obligation, a charter obligation. Otherwise, you're just sort of holding people in detention, and the forensic system is not supposed to exist for the purpose of punishment, but rather rehabilitation.
Right. And this is in regard of mental health.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they're saying in order to not treat people unjustly, then they have to meet the needs that they have. And we don't think that they currently are meeting those needs.
Inside or outside the forensic system, it sounds like.
Yes, that's quite true, yeah.
Well, thank you, Jennifer. I really appreciate your point of view. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to what you've said today? I think it's quite pointed. I think you've made a very strong case for, I don't know, discrimination for sure, and maybe beyond that, to de facto abuse, continued abuse, implicit endorsement of abuse by neglect.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that even for people whose primary concern is the economic bottom line,
right.
I think that in the mistaken belief that they are doing something that is more financially effective, creating medications in which some people make money and giving them to people so they'll sort of get better faster. I think that what they're actually doing is costing the whole society a lot more, because you end up with people who, instead of having their issues addressed and actually healing, you get a lot of people who suffer the ill effects of the medication, who end up being sort of lifelong patients because they haven't done the work necessary to get the life that they need.
So not only are these people being kept sick by a false treatment, the treatment itself is making them sicker in some cases.
In some cases, yeah, I think that's true. And there are less harmful alternatives available that are more effective.
Right.
And yet this isn't the angle that's being pursued, because it's just not the one that's in the social mindset right now.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you for addressing that, and we'll certainly put that out over the airways.
Great.
Thanks, Jennifer. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
You've been listening to mental health worker and activist Jennifer Chambers discuss the rightward political pressure to define all illness biologically, the pressures on doctors that result in the need for a national mental health advocacy organization. been listening to the Swamp Boogie Queen, Katie Webster. In the middle of the show, Two-Fisted Mama. And at the end of the show, CQ Boogie. Both from Katie Webster, Deluxe Edition. Her roots are in the gospel music that her preacher father and religious mother insisted that she play while growing up in Houston. But in the 50s, the sounds of blues, R&B, and early rock and roll were inescapable. When her parents were away, the young Katie was playing the devil's music, pounding out blues and boogies, developing a rock-solid left hand and a romping right. As a teenager, Katie won a coveted position as the piano player on almost every important blues and proto-rock record that came out of the studios of Southwest Louisiana. She sparked the records of Clifton Chenier, Slim Harpo, Lightning Slim, Phil Phillips, and her future label mate Lonnie Brooks, then known as Guitar Junior. In the early 60s, Katie was headlining the Bamboo Club in Lake Charles, packing the club with her vast repertoire. It was there that she was spotted by Otis Redding, who insisted that she join his road band the very next day. Otis became one of her dearest friends. It was only because of Katie's advanced pregnancy that she didn't accompany Otis on his final, fatal tour. But Redding's death was such an emotional blow to her that she retired from music and moved to the Bay Area to take care of her ailing parents. After almost a decade, she was coaxed out of retirement to tour Europe as a soloist, where she became a sensation. She returned to Europe nearly 30 times in the next few years, cutting albums for a number of small labels. Katie's manager, the equally flamboyant Ice Cube Slim, teamed Katie with Alligator Records, and she came to Chicago for the last three records of her career. For the Swamp Boogie Queen sessions, she brought the Silent Partners. On Two-Fisted Mama, she teamed with guitarist, arranger, songwriter Vasty Jackson, who became her close friend and bandleader. Together, they stormed the blues festival and club circuit, winning Katie a whole new generation of American fans. Katie was felled by a stroke in 1993. She lost some of the use of her left hand and almost all her eyesight, but her magnificent voice and her wonderful right hand are still in good shape, and she and Vasty make occasional festival appearances together. Her recorded legacy still speaks loud and clear. Disrespect is now archived on the web at www.radioforall.net. That's not the word for, that's the number, radioforall.net. You can now download and listen to the show whenever you want to hear Disrespect. Disrespect also has a new calendar where hopefully you can find out what next week's show is going to be. It's at www.calendric.com, C-A-L-E-N-D-R-I-C, calendric.com. Disrespect will be back next week. The show is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.